The Red, Red Flowers, M.E. Chaber. It was one of those mornings when nothing was going right. I reached the office early because I was expecting a phone call. It still hadn't come. The mail hadn't been delivered, so I was reading the morning paper. The Giants had lost the day before. The Yankees had won a doubleheader from Boston. When it's that kind of day, everything goes wrong. In disgust, I turned to the front pages. Things weren't any better there. The Russians had caught a second U-2 pilot and his plane and were promising a quick trial for the pilot. I put the paper down and stared malignantly at the phone that didn't ring. The name is March. Milo March. I'm an insurance investigator. At least, that's what it says on my license and on the door of my Madison Avenue office. Which means that if you kill your wife hoping to collect her insurance to spend on that blonde you met the other night, I'll probably be around looking for you. That's the general idea, anyway. But everyone must have been on a temporary goodness jag. I hadn't had a job in 2 weeks. The mail arrived, all bills. So it was still the same kind of day. Then the door opened and there was another mailman, this one with the registered letter. I signed for it and he went away. I opened the letter and the day was complete. It said that Major March, U.S. Army Reserve, was recalled to active duty. I was to report to an address in Washington. It was that same day. The time was 1600 or 4 o'clock, which meant that I had about 6 in which to make it. I thought of ignoring the whole thing, pretending I had never gotten the letter. But it had been registered, and when the Army wants you, they only give you 2 choices. You can walk in or be dragged in. So I made arrangements with another investigator to handle anything that came in for me and notified my answering service to route the calls to him. Then I went downtown to my apartment in Greenwich Village. I dug out my uniform and discovered it didn't need anything but a pressing. I took it into the tailor and went to the Blue Mill for a couple of martinis while being pressed. At 2 o'clock that afternoon, looking every inch the well-dressed Army officer, I was at LaGuardia Field boarding a plane for Washington. An hour later, I was telling a Washington cab driver where to take me, but I didn't give him the address in the orders, but a street corner nearby. When I got out of the cab, I still had about a half hour to spare. I spent it in the nearest gin mill over another martini. I believe that regulations state that an officer shouldn't drink while on duty, but then I wouldn't really be on duty until after I reported. Finally, I walked down the street, looking for the address. There were 3 vacant lots in the middle of the block where builders had just begun to excavate. Beyond them were several old brownstone houses of the type which in recent years have been taken over by government bureaus. I walked past the vacant lots and reached the first building. I looked at the number. It was too high. I turned and retraced my steps. But after a few steps, I realized that the number in my orders, if it had ever existed, had been where one of the vacant lots was now. I cursed to myself. If I'd had any doubts before about who was responsible for my return to active duty, they were gone. I heard steps on the sidewalk while I was still standing there with the orders in my hand. I looked around. A pleasant-faced young man was strolling toward me. I almost ignored him, but then I took another look. There was something a little too studied about his casualness, and I knew I was right. I turned back to the vacant lot and stared at it innocently.
"Pardon me, Major," the young man said as he reached me. "Is there anything wrong?"
I turned my innocence on him. "Why," I said, "I seem to have been given the wrong address."
"Perhaps I can help you," he said. "I know the neighborhood rather well. What address are you looking for?"
He moved in slightly behind me as though to look over my shoulder. Out of the corner of my eye, I caught a slight movement of his right arm, and I heard the scrape of something against cloth. "This one," I said, holding up the paper. I knew that the movement would catch his eyes for at least a couple of seconds. I lifted my left foot and brought it down hard on his right instep. There was a gasp of pain from him. I dropped the paper and pivoted, sending a right to his stomach just hard enough to bend him over. I chopped across his neck with the edge of my left hand and he dropped. He was unconscious, which was the way I wanted him. A slender blackjack was lying on the sidewalk next to him. I left him and the blackjack where they had fallen. I picked up my orders, folded the paper, and put it back in my pocket. Fortunately, the street was still empty, so there was no one to raise a cry about the man on the street. I walked back to the first house beyond the lots. It seemed like the logical place. This time I looked in. There was a tiny vestibule with an inner door, but there were no mailboxes, nameplates, or bells in it. Beyond the second door, I could see a long corridor with doors on either side. About halfway down the corridor, there was a soldier, obviously standing guard. I could have just gone in and presented my orders, and he probably would have escorted me into the office. But I was sore, and I didn't want it that way. I stepped back out onto the street. The young man was still lying on the sidewalk. I skirted around the side of the brownstone and went to the back. There was a parking area there with four cars in it. One was an army car with three stars on it. That proved I was right. I hunted around the back until I found a greasy cloth that had been used on one of the cars. I slipped up to the rear door and tried it. It was locked, but it took me only a moment to pick it. I opened the door just enough to slip the rag, bunched up in between it and the sill at the bottom. I struck a match and held it to the cloth. As soon as it began to smolder, I hurried back to the front of the house. I slipped into the vestibule against the wall and watched the soldier on guard. After a few seconds, he began to sniff and look around. He caught a glimpse of smoke trickling in through the back door and hurried toward it. The minute he moved, I had the second door open and was going quietly down the hall behind him. He was bending over the burning rag as I reached the door he'd been guarding. I opened the door silently and stepped inside. I was in a small, empty office. There was an open door leading into another, larger office. There were voices coming from that other office.
"I don't see why you had to do it this way," a man was saying. "We know March's work well enough. Why didn't you just have him come straight here and get it over with?"
"I like to test men before I give them assignments," said another voice. It was the one I knew all too well. He chuckled. "O'Connor should be here with him any minute. It'll be worth a lot to see March's face when he comes here in the office."
I lit a cigarette and went to stand in the doorway. "You don't have to wait that long," I said. "Take a good look now." The three men in the room whirled to look at me. I knew all three of them. One of them was George Hillier, the civilian head of the Central Intelligence Agency. The other civilian was Philip Emerson, his assistant. And the third man was a big, red-faced army officer with three bright, shining stars on his collar. Lieutenant General Sam Roberts. The two civilians were quickly over their surprise, and I noticed they were both grinning, but being careful to hide the fact from the general. He was still staring at me with his mouth open, but his face was beginning to get redder. "Old Tricky Roberts," I said. "You haven't changed since the days when you couldn't steal a chicken without being caught." During the fracas that was known as World War II, General Roberts and I had been in OSS together, working behind the German lines. But he'd been a colonel then.
"You're talking to a superior officer, Major March," the general said. His voice was as stiff as an overstarched collar. "I could break you for that."
"Anyone who'll talk to a superior officer ought to be broken," I retorted. "Don't give me that malarkey, General. I know you since you were a chicken colonel, polishing those eagles until they screamed. You're in trouble or you wouldn't have been recalled to active duty. You break me and who will pull your chestnuts from the fire?" His face was deep purple.
"Silence!" he roared. "How the hell did you get in here? O'Connor!"
He broke off.
"Anyway, Sanders was just outside the door with orders not to let anyone in," he finished.
There was an interruption. The outer door opened and two men came into the office. The first one was the soldier who had been on guard. He was followed by the young man I'd met in the street. He was limping and rubbing his neck.
"I beg your pardon, General," the soldier said. "But the back door was unlocked, and somebody had stuffed an oily rag in it and set it on fire.
but I didn't see anybody around.
The general glared at me and I gave him a sweet smile. He swung back to the two men.
What kind of an outfit is this?
He said angrily.
Can't anyone carry out a simple order without fouling it up?
The only one who's goofed around here, I said, is a certain three-star general. First you send me orders with a phony address on them. Then you send a pet bird dog out to point me into a trap, just so you can get a belly laugh when I'm dragged in by the heels.
Well, the general said lamely, I just wanted to see if civilian life had softened you up.
He glanced at the two men in the doorway.
How about it, O'Connor?
It was the young man who answered.
I'd say it hadn't, sir. I was in back of him, but I never had a chance.
All right, go home, O'Connor. Take a couple of days off. Sanders, go back and wait in the car for me.
The general swung his gaze back to me.
So right away you come in and beat up one of my best men, then you pick the lock on the back door, shove in a burning rag, which could have burned down the building, to draw away the guard just so you can make a grandstand play by breaking in here?
You want to play games? I said. That's what you'll get. You never saw the day you could outsmart me. You tried it plenty of times when we were behind the lines together. Any mention of the war always relaxed him. He leaned back in his chair and beamed at me.
It was a great war, wasn't it, Milo?
Save it for your memoirs, I said. What kind of trouble are you in that you have to drag me back into this monkey suit?
You're right about it being trouble, Major, George Hillier said. The three of us discussed it and decided you were the best man for the job. Yesterday, the Russians got another of our U-2 planes.
I read about it in the paper this morning, I said. I thought those were the planes that flew so high no one could shoot them down. Do the Russians have a new type of gun?
No, the general growled. The first plane had a jet flame out and went down to 30,000 feet. They couldn't have touched him at 70,000. The second plane had gone down to 20,000 feet under orders when the Russians hit his plane.
Why so low?
To make a drop, Hillier said. The pilot was supposed to drop ammunition, money, and information to a resistance group inside Russia. They got him before he succeeded in making the drop.
What does this have to do with me? I asked. It was Hillier who answered.
You've heard of Narodno Trudovoy Soyuz, Major?
I nodded. The National Alliance of Russian Solidarists. It's a group of anti-communist Russians.
Right. Their headquarters are in West Germany, but they have thousands of agents inside Russia. No one but Russians are permitted in the group. They have been very successful mostly because of what they call the molecule system. It's something like the old communist cell. Each group of agents in Russia consists of three persons, and those three do not know any other group. If one is captured and tortured, he can only inform on two other members. These NTS people have been very valuable to us in providing information. In return, we have supplied them with money and materials. Our pilot was making a drop to an American agent in Russia who was then to contact a number of these underground molecules.
Wasn't it dangerous having a man there who knew the different groups?
He didn't know them. The drop included a coded message to him, giving him the location of the groups. The message was concealed behind a map of Russia, which would be part of a regular U-pilot's equipment. If anything had happened to the plane and pilot, we wanted the Russians to think it was a regular flight.
Did they?
So far they have, but the map is one of the things they have on display in the Hall of Columns in Moscow, and the pilot knows there's a message on the back of the map. We don't believe he's being brainwashed or anything like that, but there's always a chance that he may try to use the information during his trial or later in prison to make a trade. If the Russians get the message, hundreds of agents will die, and we will lose a valuable source of information.
I was beginning to get the idea, and I didn't like it.
You mean you want the pilot and the message snatched out of the Russians' hands? Exactly.
I could smell that one coming, I said. I don't like it. You know, I've been in East Germany twice and Russia once. They have my fingerprints and considerable information about me. It won't be easy even to get into the country.
We have that problem licked,
the general said. It was the first time he'd spoken for several minutes.
How?
It is not yet known, he said, but we have a U-3 plane, same as the U-2, but it will carry two men. We fly you over Russia at 70,000 feet and you parachute in, perfectly safe.
For everybody except me, I said.
It's fairly safe, Hillier said. We have a few days' time. We're going to have you brush up on your Russian and see that you get all the other information you need. We're providing you with clothes and identification, everything you need to prove that you're a Russian. We know you speak Russian well enough to fool them. We can give you one more bit of help. There will be one underground molecule, that is, three persons who will assist you and be under your orders. For the rest, you will be on your own.
From 14 miles up in the air, I said. That's really being on your own. When the Army gets an idea, that's it. You'd think ideas were invented at West Point. Anyway, it went the way they said. I spent the next several days polishing my Russian. I took special classes each day and even went to sleep at night plugged into sleep lessons. In between, I was fitted out for a pressure suit for the parachute jump and given a complete set of clothes that had been made in Russia. I was given all kinds of identification cards, including a party card and proof that I was a worker from Rostov who was spending 2 weeks in Moscow. I was even provided with a short-handled shovel to bury the pressure suit after I landed. The shovel also had been made in Russia. 5 days after reporting for duty, I was on an army plane headed for Pakistan. 3 more days went by after we landed there. I was introduced to the pilot who would fly me over Russia, a tall blonde boy from Indiana, and stuffed into a pressure suit. I felt and probably looked like an invader from Mars. I was led out to the plane, a stubby-winged, sleek-looking black plane with a needle nose. I climbed into the rear seat and hooked my helmet into the intercom. I checked to be sure that I had the knapsack that was going to parachute in with me.
"You plugged in, Major?"
the pilot asked, his voice coming through the earphones in the helmet had a hollow sound.
"I seem to be," I said.
"All set, Major?"
"As much as I'll ever be," I grunted. "But I have a feeling that this is one thing which will never become habit-forming for me."
"There's nothing to it," he said cheerfully. "You don't even have to pull a ripcord. Your chute will open automatically when you've fallen about 8 miles.
"They didn't tell me that jokes were a part of this, or I wouldn't have come," I said. "Where are you dropping me?"
"About 10 miles southeast of Moscow. That'll give you the rest of the night to walk into the city."
"How can you be sure that's where you'll drop me?"
"Major, in this weather, I could drop you from this height and make you land on a dime. I don't even have to do any guessing about it. The whole thing's worked out mathematically."
We flew along in silence the next few minutes. Then he spoke again.
"Better start getting ready, Major. Be sure you've got everything you want to take with you. It's hard coming back after something you forgot. There's a lever in front of you. See it?"
"Yeah."
"When I tell you to go, disconnect your communication cord and pull that lever. It'll drop you through the bottom of the ship and you'll be on your way. Okay?"
"Okay,"
I muttered, but I wasn't sure it was. I felt the way I had the first time I had a serious date with a girl. Lightheaded. I checked to be sure the knapsack was fastened to my shoulders. I would have liked to check the rest of my equipment, but I didn't know anything about it, so I waited.
"Go ahead, Major,"
the pilot said quietly.
"And good luck."
"Thanks," I said.
I reached up and pulled the cord from my helmet. I took a deep breath and pushed the lever in front of me. After what seemed a very long time, I felt the tug of the parachute as it opened. After that, I was vaguely aware of swinging like a pendulum from it, but it was a pleasant sensation. Then, almost before I knew it, the ground came up to meet me and I went tumbling across it until the chute collapsed. I managed to unbuckle it and then take my helmet off. There was a gentle breeze and the smell of earth, but there were no lights. I rested for a couple of minutes, then took the knapsack off my back. I removed my gloves and opened the pack. There was a small flashlight at the very top. Shielding the light, I looked around. I was in the middle of a plowed field. I took the other clothes from the knapsack and quickly undressed and put them on. I took the shovel and dug a hole in the field. I gathered up the parachute and folded it, dropping it and the pressure suit into the hole.
I checked the knapsack to be sure that everything was out of it, then dropped it in too and shoveled the dirt back. When I was sure that the spot looked like the rest of the field, I used the light to check my compass and headed off in the direction of Moscow. About a mile on the way, I threw the shovel into a ditch, after first wiping the handle clean so there would be no fingerprints on it. It was just 4 o'clock in the morning when I approached the edge of the city. I had already decided it would be foolish to start marching through the streets at that hour in the morning, so I found a field with some bushes in it and curled up and went to sleep. It was shortly after 8 when I awakened. Now there was some traffic on the road, mostly trucks. No one paid any attention to me as I walked into the city. I soon reached a bus stop where several workers were waiting for a bus, and I joined them. I was dressed a little better than the other men, because I was, after all, on my vacation, but no one looked at me twice. I rode the bus into the center of Moscow and began to breathe a little easier. It didn't take me long to find the address I'd been given. It was one of the new apartment buildings on the Kotelnitskaya embankment. It was in Block D, Entrance C. I worked my way through the corridors until I found the apartment. I knocked on the door and hoped someone was home. The door was opened by a girl. She was small, dark-haired, and pretty. Even the loose-fitting clothes couldn't conceal that she had a full figure.
Dobro jutro, I said. U vas est mesto del imeni.
It was part of a recognition code.
Prikodjeti ljubio vreme,
she answered.
It is lovely in Moscow this time of year.
Yes, I said. I've been admiring the red flowers that grow around the Kremlin. She smiled and stepped back, opening the door wider.
Come in,
she said. I entered the apartment and she closed the door. I looked around. There were 2 rooms, small but attractive. I turned back to the girl.
We were expecting you today,
she said.
I am Natasha Naristova.
I'm Milo March, I said. And here I will be known as Mikhail Mikhailovich. I showed her my identification.
It is well done,
she said, after looking at the papers.
You had no trouble in finding the apartment?
No, I've been to Moscow before.
I know,
she said.
I remember reading about the capitalist spy Milo March, but your country proved that you couldn't have been here, didn't they?
I nodded. Do you live here alone?
No, with my brother. He is one of us. He is at work now.
You don't work?
Oh, yes. I am on the staff of Pravda. This is my day off. What are your plans? All we were told was to expect an agent and to give him any help he needed.
I want to go to the opening of the trial of the American pilot tomorrow. I have to get him and part of his possessions out of the country. Both are a threat to your group.
That will be difficult,
she said gravely.
I do not see how it can be done by only 4 of us.
I will try to do most of it myself, I told her. I don't want to risk you more than I have to.
We will do what is needed. Tonight the 3rd member of our group will be here and it can be discussed. You will stay here as long as you need to. Is there anything you would like now?
Some sleep, I said. I had only 3 or 4 hours in a field this morning. She led the way into the 2nd room and indicated the 2 beds. I stretched out on one and was soon asleep. I was awake by the middle of the afternoon. The girl was in the other room, reading. She made tea and we spent the rest of the afternoon talking. At about 5 o'clock, her brother arrived. He was a big, blonde fellow about my own age. His name was Ilya. He seemed even more pleased than his sister to learn that I was an American agent. During dinner, which Natasha cooked, he plied me with questions about America. Shortly after dinner, there was a knock on the door. Ilya went and opened it. The man who entered was short and dark, with what seemed to be a perpetually scowling face. He was introduced to me as the 3rd member of their NTS molecule. His name was Yuri Mogilev. Natasha brought out a bottle of vodka and filled 4 glasses. When they were passed around, she lifted her own.
To a free Russia,
she said, and we all drank. Then she brought out a chessboard and set it up between her brother and Yuri. They began to put the pieces on the board.
We always bring out the chessboard,
Natasha said.
Everyone believes that is the reason Yuri visits us so often. So if anyone comes while we are having a meeting, there is only a chess game.
The men moved the pieces around a few times and then settled back.
Now, said Ilya, we are ready to discuss your problems. You have papers?
I nodded. I am Mikhail Mikhailovich from Rostov. There I am a minor clerk in the offices of internal affairs. I have a 2 weeks' vacation which I am spending in Moscow. I have all the necessary papers.
Good. You will stay here, of course. If there are any questions, you and I were in the army together, and that is why you are visiting me.
He turned to Yuri.
You know the American pilot who goes on trial tomorrow. The task is to get him out of the country.
Yuri pursed his lips and scowled even more.
It's a big order. They will make the most of him for propaganda, and he will be well guarded. You have a plan?
I shook my head. I'll try to make it up as I go along. Will I have any trouble getting into the trial tomorrow?
No. That will be open to the public.
Do any of you know where the pilot is being held prisoner? Ilya glanced at Yuri, who nodded.
The Volnova prison. It is where they take important political prisoners before their trials.
Can I get any sort of rough plan of the prison and the location of the pilot's cell?
I can get that for you,
Ilya said.
By tomorrow night, I think. Anything else?
I don't think so. I have considerable money with me, most of it in American dollars. I'll probably need to spend most of it in getting out. Will the dollars be better for bribes?
I do not think so,
Ilya said.
I think you should change the dollars in the black market. Yuri can take care of it.
The four of us sat up talking late into the night, mostly about America, before we finally went to sleep. When I awakened the next morning, I was alone in the apartment. There was a note from Natasha telling me where to find things for breakfast and how to get to the Hall of Columns. I had some rolls and tea and left. A crowd was already gathering for the trial. I entered the building with three or four others dressed pretty much as I was. Out in the corridor, there was a long glass-covered case and a uniformed NVD man on guard. We filed by and looked at the things that had been taken from the captured pilot. There were a good many guns with ammunition, several watches, a big stack of ruble notes, a small bottle with a card identifying it as poison, all of the pilot's personal things, and the map. The latter was all I was interested in. Under the guise of gaping at the collection, I studied the case. It was locked as well as being guarded. I followed the others into the large room that had once been the grand ballroom of the old nobleman's club, where the trial was to be held. It was flooded with lights, and there were several television cameras set up. About half the room was filled with newspapermen, many of them from the Western countries, including America. Fortunately, I didn't see any who might recognize me. Not that they might anyway, for this was going to be a big show and all eyes would be riveted on it. The trial was quickly called to order, and the prosecutor faced the prisoner.
"What is your name?"
he asked.
"James Cooper,"
he said when the question had been translated into English.
"What is your nationality?"
"American."
"What is your profession?"
"Pilot."
There followed the reading of a long indictment of his crimes against the Soviet Union. I breathed a little easier when I realized that it contained no mention of his intending to contact the underground. It did list the guns and ammunition, but merely charged that he'd had them in case of crashing inside Russia. When the indictment was finished, Cooper was asked how he pleaded.
"Guilty,"
he said in a firm voice. Lieutenant General Boris Oblisky, the presiding judge, leaned forward.
"Weren't you aware that flying over Russia was a hostile act?"
he asked.
"I didn't think about it,"
Cooper said.
"Didn't you realize your action might bring about a war?"
"Things like that were for the people who sent me to worry about."
And so it went throughout the day, the questions and answers droning on evenly. Cooper wasn't volunteering any information, although it seemed to me that he was being more cooperative than he had to be. But then he may have been ordered to do so in case of capture. Ilya and Natasha were already at the apartment when I got there.
We had dinner together, and shortly afterwards Yuri arrived. He brought a newspaper with him, and we took turns reading the story of that day's trial. They were milking it for everything they could. Ilya had brought a hand-drawn map of Voldnova prison with the location of Cooper's cell marked on it. I examined it carefully, but the more I looked at it, the more impossible the job seemed. There were three outer doors to penetrate before reaching the cell blocks, and each one of those doors was locked and guarded. "It looks difficult," I admitted finally.
"I think it is impossible,"
Natasha said. She'd been leaning over my shoulder, looking at the map with me.
"We are told that even a regular visitor, with an official pass to visit a prisoner, must go through questioning by the three guards, and each guard communicates with the next one before you pass through the door. It is almost certain that they will be even more careful with an American prisoner."
"The biggest problem is time," I muttered. "How long do you suppose the trial will last?"
"Exactly 2 more days,"
Natasha said. "Exactly? How do you know that?" I wondered.
"The hall is reserved for only 2 more days, and the writers and cameramen from Pravda are assigned for that time. They already have other assignments for the 3rd day from now."
"At least it lets us know how much time we have," I said. "There is one other way. I don't like it, but maybe we have no choice. Ilya, is there any way we can get complete details on the transportation of Cooper to and from the trial? I mean, routes, time, method of taking him, and the number of guards?"
"I think so," he said slowly. "There is a man with whom I sometimes play chess at lunchtime. He would know, and I think he could be bribed."
"I'll give you the money," I said. "Try to get it tomorrow. Can you take extra time at lunch or take the afternoon off?"
"I can take the afternoon off."
"Then bring whatever you get here and I'll meet you. There are a couple of other things I want to ask you about, but first there is something I want to do. I'll be back soon."
"Where are you going?"
Natasha asked. "Out," I said with a smile.
"Let me go with you,"
she said.
"I can be of help."
"Not this time," I told her firmly. "I'll be back within an hour." I smiled at her and left. It was still early in the evening, but there wasn't much traffic. I hit the small side streets and began walking and looking. I'd been searching for more than a half hour before I found what I was looking for. I was on a narrow, dimly lit street. There were 2 or 3 small restaurants and a few shops along it, and the rest were apartment houses. There was a man walking ahead of me. As he reached a street light, I saw he was wearing an MVD uniform. I quickened my step. I timed it carefully so as not to get too near until he was in between streetlights. He started to cross a narrow street angling off to the left, and I hurried forward.
"Comrade," I called,
just loud enough to reach him, but not enough to attract the attention of anyone in the apartment houses. He hesitated and looked back, peering at me.
"What is it?"
he called. He sounded irritable.
"I need help," I said. I was almost up to him. "I am off duty," he said,
his tone clearly indicating that he didn't want to be bothered.
"It will only take a minute," I said.
I reached him and looked around. There was no one on the street within 2 blocks of us.
"It is only that I need some advice about something I found on the street." "What is it?"
he asked. I reached into my pocket and pulled out a piece of paper. I held it out.
"This," I said.
He took the paper and held it up, trying to get enough light on it to see it. I chopped my hand across his neck as hard as I could. He grunted deep in his throat and started to fall. I caught him and dragged him into the deep shadows of the alley. I went back to retrieve the paper I'd handed him. Then I went back and quickly stripped off his uniform. I rolled it up into a ball with the gun inside and tucked the whole thing under my arm. It had taken no more than 3 or 4 minutes, and he was still unconscious as I stepped back to the street and walked away. The uniform looked like any bunch of clothes under my arm, and I didn't draw a second glance from any of the few people I met on the way back to the apartment. Even so, I felt better when Natasha opened the door in answer to my knock. I stepped inside and she closed the door.
"I am glad you are back,"
she said.
"What do you have there?"